Hey, it's A24, and this is the A24 podcast. For this episode, we bring you a conversation between two visionary filmmakers, Paul Schrader and Sofia Coppola. Paul and Sofia have much in common, as writer-directors who've built careers entirely outside the studio system, each making movies only they can make. We were excited to bring them together to talk about Paul's new movie, First Reformed, and what it's like to be a filmmaker today. A warning, if you haven't seen First Reformed, you'll want to skip ahead exactly 2 minutes when Sofia asks Paul about the movie's ending. Here's Paul Schrader and Sofia Coppola.
All right. Now, Sofia, I'm Paul Schrader.
I'm Sofia Coppola.
Have we met?
I feel like I've met you as a kid. I remember.
Yeah, I think the last time I met you, you were about half as tall as you are.
But I remember you coming to, I met you at a lunch in my adult life. Because I remember asking you about American Gigolo, and you had told me that John Travolta was originally supposed to play the part, and I love that movie, so I was excited to ask you about that. But I know you more from growing up as a peer of my father.
Well, a little younger.
But, yeah.
And
Mishima.
So Francis and George produced Mishima, and we did the post up there in San Francisco. And of course, I have all those ties with Tom Letty. So I was just back up there. Oh. So there's a lot of interesting things to talk about. I think the most interesting is, how does one get a movie seen today?
Yes, I was happy to hear that at A24 they were saying that your new movie is doing so well and people are going to see it, and I'm always curious about, and I love the theater experience of going to...
Well, this is what I found. Around 10 or 12 independent films a year rise above the crowd and are noticed by the general public. And this is out of possibly 15,000 or more. And, you know, how do you get to be one of those 10 is a very big question. And I've started to realize in the current marketplace, which of course changes every year, is that first you have to pass through the gatekeepers, which are the festivals. And then the next stage is running the gauntlet. And what I found with First Reformed is we passed the gatekeepers, Venice, Telluride, Toronto, New York. And A24 bought us out of Toronto. And then there was a whole period of special screenings for groups. I did a lecture tour at various seminaries, small festivals, overseas festivals.
It's like a full-time job.
And then in March, David Frankel, who you're just talking to, called me into a meeting in this room. He said that they were going to change the release pattern, and they're going to change the dates, change the theaters, and we were talking about the campaign. And he obviously saw that I looked very concerned. And he said, Paul, this is good news. This is a good news meeting. But my point being, it was almost 6 months after they bought the film until they had run it through enough gauntlets.
To figure out when they're going to release it.
Or how much push they're going to put behind it.
Right.
Yeah. Now, just because you make a movie, just because someone buys a movie, you know, doesn't mean anybody is ever going to see it.
Yes, I know. I feel like that. Yeah, I feel like the last time I made a movie last year, half of the effort and work is the year of just trying to get it out there and get people to see it. So it's always a mystery and a struggle.
And particularly if you get caught in award season like Greta did, where, you know, it's from Labor Day to April.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how anyone, it's a full-time. But that's exciting when movies, break out, because you're right, it's so rare.
Yeah, I mean, and there's almost no way, you know, you can predict. You can do certain things, but, you know, if a movie hits the zeitgeist, it's just luck. You know, we hit the zeitgeist with Taxi Driver all those years ago.
Yeah.
What degree of calculation was there? None to my knowledge. It just happened.
Yeah, it just happens. Yeah, now it seems like there's a lot more put behind it. And this whole kind of campaigning, and that didn't exist.
No.
Yeah.
You were asking me a minute ago, your friend, she was editing?
My friend Tamara Jenkins was editing at, I think, Post Factory, and she said she met you there when you were working on First Reform, and that you were also editing a movie with my cousin Nicholas Cage.
Yes. Well, what happened was, about 6 years ago, I had a terrible situation happen, and They tried to kill me, or at least that's how it felt to me. They took my film away, and Nick and I and other people disowned it, and they dumped it. And, you know, I sort of descended into despair and alcoholism.
Terrible, yeah.
And I thought, well, this is how my career is going to end, with a fiasco. You know, this will be the enduring taste in my mouth. And
what was the film called? You know,
it was called Dying of the Light. So then I was still in touch with Nick, and I said, Nick, you know, we should work together again and get it right. And I'll get this stain off our clothes, meaning primarily my clothes. I don't think he's going to get
it. That's a terrible feeling.
Yeah. And so then a film came along that I thought he would be good for, Dog Eat Dog. And I said to the people, I think I can get Nick Cage for this, but you have to give me final cut, because I won't go to him without final cut after what happened last time. So I said, okay, you can have final cut.
I can't believe that you wouldn't always be able to have that.
I never felt I needed it before. I mean, in the 70s and 80s, you're always dealing with movie people, people who like movies, you would disagree. Sometimes the movie would get better or worse, but
they were movie people.
Yeah. Now, the whole group of people in the film business who not only don't go to movies, they don't even like them much.
Yeah.
And so how do you deal with these people? And then all of a sudden Final Cut starts to mean something. So I made this Gonzo film with Nick and Willem Dafoe, Dog Eat Dog, my sort of Tarantino film. And it was just completely outrageous film. That sort of brought me back to life. And then I started thinking about, what can I do now that I have this Final Cut thing? What movie have I always been afraid to make? And I said, that's spiritual film, you know, because the economics were never right. You know, it was always a financially irresponsible film to make, and that, you know, somebody would try to take it away from you at some point. I said, but now we can get the budget down low enough so that it's responsible. And now I can use my final cut to do nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, before I used it to be outrageous. Now I can use it to be quiet.
Yeah.
And so that's how that came about. Well, I went to that editor I'd used on Dog Eat Dog, because while I was editing that, I realized what I was doing wrong with Dying of the Light. I realized I needed to be much more aggressive with the editing. And this editor, Ben Rodriguez, is a student of Hank Horwitz, who did Natural Born Killers. So he's in that school. And he was...
And he edited First Reform?
Yeah, and I said to him, he edited Dog Eat Dog. And I said to him, I'm going to hire you for First Reform, but I don't need you for First Reform. You know, it's a very simple job. But we'll get through it in probably 7 weeks. Then I want you to re-edit Dying of the Light, which I don't own legally. And we'll just edit it without permission. So we were editing both simultaneously. This very, very quiet film, and one this completely gonzo film. And, of course, I don't own it. So I had a little walk around. I put it in my archive at UCLA Film and Harry Ransom in Austin and here at MoMA. So if you call them up,
we can see the new version.
Yeah. Or you can go to YouTube and just type in Schrader Rotterdam. And then you will see an hour and a half lecture I did about the whole process around 25 minutes of clips of the old version versus the new version and how I had done that.
Will you try to get it re-released?
I don't own any of it. Also, I offered to do all of this for free.
Yeah.
And I was turned down because there's a lot of bad feelings.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
And and so now I find myself in the opposite position, which was after Dying of the Light. I said, this is how it's going to end. Now, I'm after First Reformed, I'm in the position of saying, well, this is how it should end, which is almost as intimidating.
Yeah.
You know, you start thinking, well, you know, if this is my last film, it's a pretty good
Did you really approach it as your last film?
No.
Or every project you have to think?
Well, not really. Yeah. I mean, but after a certain age, you know, you see also Tom Petty's dead. You know, did Tom Petty plan to make that his last album?
Right.
You know?
But this is a movie that you've always wanted to make?
It's a movie
subject matter that you've always wanted to
make. It's a movie I always didn't want to make.
Right. Did you grow up with religion?
Yeah. I'm a product of the Christian Reformed Church, so that would be Westside Christian, Grand Rapids Christian High, Calvin. And before I got involved in filmmaking, I wrote a book of theological aesthetics called Transcendental Style in Film. And it was about Ozu and Bresson and Dreyer.
How did you learn about Ozu?
I learned about Ozu from Don Ritchie. What happened was I had this theological education, and then I had this love of the movies. And all of a sudden I started seeing in specific films a bridge between my sacred past and my profane present. But it wasn't a bridge of content. It was a bridge of style. And as soon as I made that revelation, I said, you know, you can connect these things stylistically. Uh-huh. Content is kind of immaterial. So I wrote that book about it, and I was published in 72. And I've rewritten it, bringing it up to date, and that's coming out in 2 days. People tried to connect my films with that book, and I said, no, that's not me. I like those films. I've written about those films, but I myself am too intoxicated with sex and violence, action and empathy. You know, these are not elements in the transcendental toolkit. You know, you will never catch me, you know, on that thin Bresonian ice. I'm not going to go out there. I'm going to fall in if I go out there. And that's the way it was for decades. And then 3 years ago, I was giving Pavel Pavlovsky the National Society of Film Critics Award for Ida. So when we were talking about spirituality in movies, talking about my book, talking about the new economics of film, and I walked uptown and I said, you know, you're going to be 70 next year. It's time now. It's time to write that movie. Swore you would never write.
The scariest.
And once, actually, I made the decision to cross that bridge, it became relatively easy. One of the things that had always been holding me back was feeling that I would walk into a spiritual arena and fail. And that, to me, seemed like the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
I'd rather fail in the secular arena. But once I said, okay, you know, you're 70, you've got Final Cut. If you're not going to do it now, you're never going
to
do it.
Yeah, you have to. But it's always good to do something scary. But I feel like that there's a similarity in that character, obviously, to Travis Pickle. Were you thinking about similar spirituality at that time?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was is in March of 1969, I was a critic for the LA Free Press. I went to the Los Feliz Theater, the lovely theater, and saw Pickpocket. And in that 75-minute movie, two things happened. One is I realized that there was a contact between spirituality and cinema, and it was a contact of style. And out of that came the book. The other thing I saw was this kid in this room, writing in a journal, going out, committing some crimes, writing some journal some more. And I was living at the time with a group of UCLA film students who were making a biker film for Roger Corman called Naked Angels. And I was a film student and not a filmmaking student. And I thought what they were doing was just so declassé. I was very elitist. Mm. And, you know, I said, we, the film critic community, will tell you when you make a good film. And I'm sure they thought the same way. And then I saw that film and I said, wow, I can make a film like that. You know, maybe there is a place for me in this trashy business. You know, I could make that film. And then 3 years later, I wrote Taxi Driver, which is that film. You know, the guy in the room with his journal goes out and moving on some kind of personal arc. And so now, 50 years afterward, those two seeds, which dropped into the Petri dish at that same morning.
There's a connection.
And finally connected again in this film, First Reformed, where you have that style and that character coming around.
Right.
Now, I've used that character a number of times. You know, when he was young, he was lonely and a taxi driver. And then he was narcissistic and a gigolo. And then he was anxious and a drug dealer, like Sleeper. And then he was superficial and a society walker. and now he's finally a minister, and he suffers from despair.
So they're all the same,
yeah.
Or different sides of yourself.
Yeah, well, different. It's a progression through life.
Yeah,
you know, every time you sort of come to an interesting position, and that character sort of swings around again. I don't know if you
have... It meets
have,
you in a different incarnation.
Yeah. I don't know whether you have a similar character. You say, it's time I take a look at her again.
Yeah. Yeah. I always wonder, usually when I'm starting to write, I don't know why I'm drawn to it, and then afterwards I start to see the connection. When you start, did you say it's time to revisit that character, or he kind of creeps up on you?
Well, here's how it happened with Light Sleeper. It was interesting. I was 40, a little over, and I wanted to do a midlife movie. And I must have thought about this for almost a year, going through all the cliches and the college professor and the guy quits his job, becomes an adventurer. And so I could not come up with a decent midlife metaphor. And then I was asleep and in a dream at about 5 a.m., a character came to me, and he was a drug dealer that I used to know. His name was John. And he came right smack up to my face, and I woke up in a start. And I thought, wow, that was vivid. Well, I haven't thought about him in a year. And I said, what were he talking about? And I thought, oh, he was asking me about the movies. And then I realized,
wow,
this is my guy.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't find him, so he found me.
That's great.
And I got up right then and there, started making notes, tracked him down that very same day, he and his boss. He ended up being played by Willem Dafoe, his boss, by Susan Sarandon. And it was the same taxi driver guy, the guy with the journal, the guy, only now he's in the back seat of the car with envelopes of drugs rather than the front seat of the car.
Right, that's so interesting. And now here he is again in a different stage of his life and dealing with modern, what's happening.
Yeah, so it takes amount of living to return. You know, you can't do a Woody Allen with those kind of characters. You can't write about them every year.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Well, that's interesting. And did you have Ethan Hawke in mind, or did you find him after?
No, I mean, you know, normally I...
Do you think of actors when you're writing?
I try not to. Do you?
I do, because it helps me to picture actors. Certain parts.
I think it's just the opposite. Because if you're sitting there typing, you're writing a speech.
Yeah.
And now you hear Denzel Washington say it. You say, wow, that's a great speech. No, it's not a great speech.
Denzel, it's just they would make it good.
Denzel is a great actor. And so I try at all costs not to think of an actor.
Oh, that's
because
funny.
It...
I've been cheating.
Yeah. And about halfway through this, now there is a certain physiognomy of a suffering man of the cloth. You know, Claude Ledoux and Country Priest or and Montgomery Clift and I Confess. So you start thinking of actors who fit that bill, and Jake Gyllenhaal and Oscar Isaac and Ethan. And Ethan was 10 years older than the other two. And he was just starting to get some very interesting wrinkles in his face. You know, some of those guys, it takes a long time for the boyhood to go away.
Right.
Like Griffin Dunne was like 25 for 30 years.
Yeah, that's true.
And and Ethan is all of a sudden now becoming much more interesting that way. And I always thought he would be very good as an internalized actor.
Yeah, I feel like I've never seen him.
Yeah.
That.
His personality is kind of, he has a kind of goofy personality. That it's a sort of a post-hippie kind of attitude toward things. And so the first time I met with him, I said, this is a lean-back performance. You know, whenever you detect the viewer getting interested, start leaning away. You know, don't give in. Don't do, you know, see how far you can get away from them.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, it felt very like we were having to lean forward to try to...
And that's sort of what it is with these spiritual kind of things. You can't really push anybody into the mystery. All you can do is guide them. But those steps they take...
They have to take.
Yeah, they have to take. You know, you can't play spiritual music or have a spiritual plot gimmick, and people say, "Oh, I found God."
Yeah.
No. When you decide to touch the mystery, it's because you've been put in a kind of a tight spot by the artist, and one of the ways you can go is to jump forward, and that's what that whole notion of transcendental style was about. How do you stylistically corner a viewer so that
they're trapped?
He wants to jump forward, you know, jump into the mystery.
Yeah, no, I felt like it was, you're in an uncomfortable state watching it, but you can't look away, and it's an interesting state that's unusual in movies, I think.
Yeah, and going back to Taxi Driver, that's something that I learned then, and there's two devices. One is narration, which I've always loved, particularly when it's written, it has to be written before it. And I regarded as intravenous feeding. I'm going to put a tube in your arm.
Right.
And I'm going to start giving you nourishment. And you won't be able to taste it, and you won't be able to feel it, but it's going to fill up your body.
When it starts to take effect after.
Yeah. And that's one thing I'm going to do. And the other thing I'm going to do is tell you a story from only one point of view, a monocular story. So you're seeing this one character go about his days only.
Well, you stay with him the whole time. You don't ever see anything without him, right?
Whether it's, Travis Bickle or whether it's this guy. So after about 45 minutes of hearing this guy talk and seeing only what he sees, you are now identifying with him. How can you not?
Right.
If you're still in that theater, you are identifying. He starts to go off the rails. Just a little bit, then a little bit further, and then a little bit further, until you come to the position where you are still identifying with someone, but you no longer think he's worthy of your identification. And that's the crunch, that's a little crevice. You can lay down someone's skull and cause them. And who knows what the viewer is going to do at that point? I mean, because you can't predict that. But you know that you put the viewer in a very uncomfortable place and they're going to react somehow.
Yeah, I feel like you don't see it coming. Or you start to see clues of it, but then before you know it, you've gone farther than you expected to. And like, wait, when did that happen?
So.
And I was surprised how violent it is for such a sparse...
Oh, there is no violence per se. It's obviously an anticipation of violence.
Yeah, but there's like the one scene in the woods, like it's very, I don't want to say it. It's shocking, it's not.
Yeah, but there again, when you withhold things from people,
and
let's take the case of music.
Right.
So now you see a scene and a kid's lying in the snow with his head half blown off, and there's no music. And part of you as a viewer say, come on, play some music, tell me how I'm supposed to feel,
Oh yeah, I hate when they overdo the score and it tells you how to feel.
Yeah.
Or it leads you too much.
Yeah, and that's another way to sort of create unease, I want to ask, you said you're writing now?
I am. I'm kind of procrastinating and avoiding writing. But yes, I had something I started a couple years ago that I put away, and now I took it out to try to come back to it. Have you ever done that where you abandoned something and came back to it? Or?
Actually, I wanted to do a film 20 years ago with Arnold Schwarzenegger, a remake of a Bud Bedeker Western, and then he decided to run for governor. And I never got the rights, but now I may get the rights back.
Oh, wow. it still interests you?
Well, it's 20 years old. It needs to be updated.
Yeah.
All I know for sure right now is I've got to do something completely different. And, people have come up to me after this film and said, when are you going to make another film like that? I said, I don't know if I ever will.
After every film, do you go through that period of searching?
I sense that you and I have this in common, which is, part of the fun of making films is seeing if you can do something.
Yeah.
I've never done this before. I did a little Kickstarter movie with Bret Easton Ellis.
Oh, yeah.
Part of the fun of it, we did Lindsay Lohan, a porn star.
Yeah.
Part of the fun was, can we do this, Bret?
Yeah.
Can we actually pull this off?
That is half the fun of it.
Yeah. Or, you know, can I make a Tarantino movie? Or, you know, can I do this kind of movie?
You're setting up a challenge for yourself.
Yeah. And because so often I go to a movie theater and I look up at the screen. I say, you know, how do they stay awake?
Yeah.
Well, these people have made this movie 10 times now.
Yeah, oh yeah. No, it's so great when you see something you haven't seen a million.
But
how did you start with, I know you decided to face the fear of doing something in this subject matter, but then did the character just come to you? And
well,
and it feels so much about the current
state of. And you know, it's that character I've written about before, and the first thing I did is started rewatching the films of this ilk that I thought had worked and that were effective. And just, you know, checking through the landscape and watching about 2 dozen films. And then,
in the church and the
yeah.
priest.
And you start, you know, slow cinema. And you start picking up things. You know, and a lot of what we do is, you know, simply theft
yeah.
or assemblage, you know. And so, and the secret of stealing is that you have to steal around.
My dad or grandfather always said, steal from the best.
Yeah.
Their slogan.
But you can't keep going back to the same bet. You can't keep going back to the same 7-Eleven. They're going to catch you.
Right, right.
So you can go to the best, but you can't be the same best. So you go to, you know, you go over to the floral shop.
And you mix them together.
You go over to the gas station. Then you go over to that little hot dog stand that nobody goes to.
Right.
And then you put them together. And that's all any of us ever do.
Yeah, no, that's true. I was talking to my dad about the conversation, and he said, oh, I saw Blow Up, and I wanted to make a Blow Up. And I had no idea. But I was like, yeah.
And then De Palma saw Conversation, and he wanted to make Blow Up.
Yeah, it's so funny. So then I'm curious also about how your writing. Do you... Like I notice, I can write better at night than during the day.
Well,
do you have any rituals?
I'm a binge writer. I don't consider myself a real writer. I think a real writer writes every day. But I know
that's
I write.
What I've heard, and I can't do that either. So that makes me feel better. You just sit down until the idea is done.
And I used to be a night writer, but that was always fueled by nighttime additives.
Oh.
You know, the caffeine, the nicotine, the cocaine, the alcohol. Yeah. And then I had children. And it took almost a year to learn to write during the day.
I'm so glad because I've been struggling with this and no one ever talks about it.
Yeah. And well, you know, I used to you know, start writing about 10:30, 11, and write till 5. And boy, you know, it would just buzz along. But gradually, I started doing more drugs and making less pages. So at the beginning, there wasn't many drugs, but there was like 15 pages. And then there was a lot of drugs, and there was like two pages.
Oh,
and then you're written and you say, oh, am I writing? Am I taking drugs to write, or am I pretending to write in order to justify taking drugs?
I never thought about that.
And so then I went on the day shift, and that took a while. And now I'm still on the day shift. But,
How many pages can you do in a good day? Or average?
Well, I tend to write very fast. And the way I do that is I outline and tell the story.
So you know where you're going. You write out the whole story. Do you know what the ending? Do you know where?
Yeah.
You know?
I can tell you what will happen on page 55 and a half before I start to write.
Well,
because it's all in my outline.
Oh, okay, I never do an outline.
And I've done this, and I use the outline to make an oral presentation. I tell the story. And every time I tell the story, I redo the outline. I tell the story, redo the outline. Then at some point, you start putting in projected page counts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So now you have a feeling of what page you're on when this part of the story kicks in. And you do that enough. If you can tell somebody a story for 15 minutes, 45 minutes, and they listen, you've got a movie. And What happens if you tell a story enough? One of two things happens. One is you tire of it and it dies on you. And that's a good day because you've saved yourself from writing something that was going to die anyway.
Oh.
Or the other thing sometimes to happen, which it says, I'm sick of being told. You know, don't tell me one more time. Write me. It's time now.
Right.
And then the writing comes, you know, quite quickly. And occasionally I have stumbled into this process where I had two-thirds of the story, but not the last third, and I thought it would come.
Yeah, and didn't?
Didn't come.
I always feel like I'm rushing to get to the end of that,
that
part. That's interesting. And would you say this is a happy ending?
This,
well, that's too simple.
What do you think?
I don't want to give away anything.
Well, yeah.
No, I wasn't sure. No, I think it's mixed. I think that's more interesting than, you don't want to have one or the other. Of course, it's mixed emotions.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what the ending is.
Yeah.
It's done. So
is he going to be okay?
It can be read in one of two ways. Well, one is that sort of miracle has occurred and his life has been spared.
Right.
The other is equally, in my sense, optimistic, which is he drinks the Drano and he's on all fours and he's throwing up his stomach.
Oh, he's imagining.
And God comes over to him, who has not talked to him for the whole movie, and says, Reverend Tolt, you want to know what heaven looks like? Here it is. This is exactly what it looks like. It looks like one long kiss.
Oh.
and that's the last thing he sees.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I took it as I wasn't sure whether it was real or not. So I wondered if you decided.
Yeah, we were tweaking it in the editing. You know, when people see it, trying to make it like half and half. So whenever I showed it, I'd say, "Is he alive or dead?" When I'm trying to get about the same amount of hands to go up for both.
Oh right, but do you? Maybe we shouldn't say it on our podcast, but should. Do you have an idea which side it's more on, or are you going both ways?
No, whenever people thought it was one way, I shift the editing so it's the other way, so that I didn't know.
Right, okay.
And because a number of people have interpreted the ending of Taxi Driver as a fantasy, and I don't have a problem with that ending, but it's not what I intended. And so this time, I actually intended.
Played with that. Oh, that's interesting. Are you traveling around with the film? And
yeah, I've been on tour. I think just coming down to the end of it, and I've decided, just to take this victory lap. You know, but unfortunately, but now the victory lap is coming to an end, and. Time to get back to work.
I have to face a blank page. Yeah. Do you find it, no, it's nice when people are interested in your work, but do you find it annoying to have to explain what you're trying to do instead of just having people watch it?
Well, if you've hidden enough nuggets in there.
You have something to talk about.
Yeah, you can sort of say, by the way, you notice, open up that door, and... So, there are things in the film that very few people notice. But when you call their attention to it, it's actually more interest.
Oh, yeah. And were you thinking about making something to respond to the state of things now? Or did that just kind of seep in when you were working on it?
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to. For thousands of years, human beings have been having a hypothetical discussion, why are we here and what will become of us? And now for the first time, that discussion is seeming not so hypothetical.
Right.
And the possibility that the species as now constituted will not see the end of this century. That's a lot of gravitas.
Yes. But was that in your mind when you were starting out with this character, or he kind of...
Well, I knew that the...
Would have to be about...
Yeah, I mean, because you have, the sickness unto death is what Kierkegaard called it, which is despair. So he's in religious despair. But that despair is somewhat selfish, and it is forbidden by the church, suicide. And St. Augustine said, you know, suicide is sin. However, he said, unless you're Samson. And then it's resurrection because you're a martyr. So you can see this guy, and he's very, very tempted by despair to go into suicide. And then he catches this virus whereby he sees himself becoming a martyr. And now that's really sick too. But it's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about how many ways you can approach that. And from here, do you know what this will lead you to next, or do you take a time to?
I'm toying around with three things. One is a complete style piece, and another is a contemporary Western, and another is the scariest one, which is about my brother.
Oh. Don't you always have to do the scariest one?
I don't know. You know, I wrote a film about my father. I wrote a film about my mother. And I think they're two of the weakest films I did because there was not enough metaphorical distance between me and the subject, you know?
Oh.
Whereas if I could make them a taxi driver or a gigolo, I got enough distance.
So they were directly their stories?
Yeah.
Which film?
Hardcore was about my dad, and Light of Day was about my mom.
But it was too directly?
Well, yeah, because they were characters, you know, father. And now the idea I'm writing about my brother is about a brother, and I keep thinking, maybe, you know, am I too close? Am I too close?
Oh, that's interesting.
And and I came to this idea because my brother died about 10 years ago, and now his widow is dying. And she was a hoarder, so we had to clean out her house. And she kept everything, and I went through like 100 or 50 boxes. And I found what I was looking for because I never save stuff. You know, I've thrown my life out the window like a greasy rubber. But my brother saved stuff. And from 1966 to 1970, I wrote him every other week. Oh. And I wrote him everything.
Wow.
Every movie I saw, coming to UCLA, going to film school, meeting Pauline Kael,
wow.
All of it, you know? And he had all those letters.
Oh, wow.
And now Film Common is going to print them, you know, one a day for a while.
Oh, wow, that's so great.
But I was just thrown back into that. And so then I started coming up with an idea. But I stopped after 40 pages because I was just getting too close to it. And it wasn't good enough. I could feel it getting thinning out. So what I'm going to do now is back up and start at the beginning again. Maybe they're not brothers. I'm not sure. You know, or maybe there is.
But how to take something like that without it being so direct?
Well, yeah. How to keep it from being, or, you know, maybe I need to put an external event in there rather than just family.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and maybe there has to be an outside danger.
Or,
a mysterious death of
right.
some sort.
That's a good warning for me to keep in mind, because everyone's always drawn to writing about their family, so
yeah.
To make sure not to fall in the trap of
yeah.
something too close.
Yeah, although I did like that film they did here at A24. Did you see that film, Krisha?
Oh, yes.
Now that's all that an actual family.
That was incredible.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I was just thinking about
And that was the main character was like, was she the aunt of the filmmaker?
Yeah, they were all family with a handful of exceptions. That was the actual family.
Wow.
They were
in the union. Yeah.
And
yeah, that was really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I found it a movie that I just couldn't imagine being able to do, you know.
Yeah.
I was just looking at your filmography, and you know, because you're from a different generation, so all this stuff gets mixed in. You know, the music and the little, you know, I'm pretty much straight from the screenwriting generation and then to the directing generation, and I haven't veered from that. But I see all the temptation. You did an opera?
Oh, yeah, I did. But just because I was asked to, and I felt like I couldn't say no because it was terrifying. But it was in the live theater, which I'd never done.
Yeah, I was asked to.
Really?
And I was terrified.
I wanted to say that.
And I didn't do it.
Yeah, I didn't want to, but I'm glad I did because I felt like it was scary and I learned something. But
are you a musician?
No, I've always liked music, and there are a lot of musicians in my family. My father's father and his uncle are conductors and composers. So, so my dad's uncle knew La Traviata very well and explained it to me. And I just did it to do something scary and challenge myself. But I wonder, like, you have such a strong visual style. Obviously, you're a director, but from a writer, I just think of like.
Well, it took me a while. The first two films. I just illustrated. It wasn't until the third film.
Where was American Gigolo?
That was the third one.
Oh, it has such a great style.
Yeah, and that was because of this guy, Scarfiotti, Nando.
Oh.
Who I had brought over from Bertolucci. He had done Conformist and Last Tango.
Of course. Yeah, the sets, everything, the look of it. So
and I just great. I just put myself really at his feet.
But you knew you need.
I needed
how did you
that.
Think to combine that?
And I needed a master, a mentor, and I had seen Conformist, and I heard that he and Bertolucci were having a little bit of a falling out over Novecento, so I went over there and invited him to come to the U.S.
Wow.
And we did those two films together, and we became very, very good friends.
Wow.
And you know he gave me eyes. The two people right around that same period, Charles Eames and Scarfiotti, because I was raised in
you knew Charles Eames?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I was raised in a church environment where if you had something to say, you use words or songs. You don't use images.
Oh, interesting.
You know, the churches are just four white walls.
Right.
And
that's frivolous or something.
Yeah. And so I always thought ideas were words. And it took me a while to learn that images are also ideas. And Eames was, I was doing an article, as a critic, I was doing an article on Charles. And I started hanging out at 301 Washington. And then my wife at the time got a job there and she became one of his designers.
Oh.
And that was the first time this whole notion of images on ideas. I just hadn't even thought of that.
Wow, that's so interesting that that's where you were introduced to that idea. Like, you're...
This is an idea. You know, this is not a white coffee cup. This is an idea. And then did those films with Nando and then.
That was his idea to get Armani.
I was making a film about Los Angeles, so I wanted to de-Los Angelize Los Angeles. So I got, I went to the Axis powers. I went to Germany and Italy and got some music from Germany and the look from Italy.
Oh, yeah. How did you think to get Giorgio Moroder? It was such a good combination of that with the design.
I'm not quite sure how that happened. I'm not quite sure. But, I mean, I was very interested in that, but that thing, I was interested in him, and I was interested in Jean-Michel Jarre.
Yeah.
And what's the other one? Trans-Europe Express.
Kraftwerk.
Kraftwerk.
Right.
Yes. So that was all in the air.
Oh, right at that time.
Yeah.
That's cool. And was the story an original story, or was it based on something? And I know I should go on and on about American Gigolo, but I just love that movie so much. And Lauren Hutton, has she acted before?
Yes, she had done one thing before.
Oh. Did you just know her from around?
Actually, in Sue Menger's one-woman show that Bette Midler did on Broadway, she tells the story.
Did you work with Sue Menger?
Bette as Sue.
Oh, I met Sue Menger's, but I never saw the show.
And so she tells the story about how she has a dinner party at her house and sits me next to Lauren Hutton.
That's how it happened?
Yeah.
Oh, I love knowing that story. Oh, thank you. Well, so, lives on.
Do you have a title for your thing yet? Does that last?
No, I do, but I don't know if I'll ever get my script together.
Yeah, I know.
That feeling.
you live here?
I do. I live in the West Village.
Whereabouts?
Morton, near Hudson.
Oh, I was just there. I was just...
Near, like, isn't it the Lug?
I was at 10 Hudson this morning.
Oh, really? Yeah. And where are you?
I have a place in Chelsea, but mostly I'm up in Putnam Valley.
Oh, okay.
Have a lake house. Do you have a country house?
No, I still go visit my family in Napa. I know it's not that close, but...
You know, I don't know. The first time I was at Skywalker, this was way back then, and George, there were a handful of buildings there, you know, and George had this big book. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's a book of drawings. Okay, and it was a history of Lucas Valley.
Oh, no.
The very first people who came to Lucas Valley, the first shacks that were built, the first permanent building that was built, and just going through all the years, the history of Lucas Valley. And I said, wow, that's really great. I was talking to Luddy afterward. And I said, did he ever show you the book? And Tom said, he made up the book. None of it is true.
Really?
There was never anybody in Lucas Valley.
He invented the whole thing?
He bought Lucas Valley and then invented a history for it.
Oh, my God. I never heard that story. That's so funny.
Well, thank you, Sophia. That's great.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate all the writing insights and excited for your new film.
I think the world is ready for another Sofia Coppola film.
Oh, thank you. I'll try to get to it.
Thanks so much for listening. Look out for episode 5 next month. The A24 podcast is produced by us, A24. Special thanks to Doug and Aaron at Robot Repair, who composed our theme.